Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What do you want to talk about? Car makers or the bailout? Or the bailout of car makers? Because we've got it all today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by CSX, working to reduce traffic and pollution by carrying the load of 280 trucks by rail. CSX, how tomorrow moves. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Tuesday. It is the 18th of November. That means it's been about 6 weeks since Congress passed the financial industry's big bailout. In that time, though, pretty much everything we were told about the way it was going to work has been thrown out the window. Today, almost half the money's already been spoken for. It's been spent buying stakes in banks and in AIG, the big and bottomless insurance company. Nothing has gone to buy up bad mortgages or stem the rising tide of foreclosures. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports the Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson got an earful about that this morning on Capitol Hill.
Hank Paulson had a rough day defending his $700 billion bailout.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, Mr. Secretary, we don't have a lot of time.
Congressman Barney Frank and others repeatedly interrupted Paulson and berated the Treasury Secretary for sidestepping questions about the Troubled Asset Relief Program, a.k.a. the TARP. They're angry that Paulson's refused to put money on the table to slow foreclosures.
The prudent course at this time is to conserve the remaining funds available from the TARP.
Paulson says as banks start lending again, that should slow foreclosures and voluntary bank programs will help. But Barney Frank wants more.
We understand that there are other activities going on. I don't accept them as a substitute for using the authority that we very specifically and carefully wrote into the TARP and that was essential to it getting passed.
Frank likes a plan proposed by Sheila Bair, chairman of the FDIC, who sat just feet away from the embattled Treasury Secretary. Bair's proposed using $24 billion from the bailout to renegotiate 1.5 million troubled loans.
Eligible borrowers would get lower interest rates and, in some cases, longer loan terms and principal forbearance to make their monthly payments affordable.
The feds would share administrative costs and any losses if borrowers defaulted again. Bair believes her plan would stabilize housing prices by stopping unnecessary foreclosures.
If this program can keep home prices from falling by just 3 percentage points less than would otherwise be the case, over $500 trillion would remain in homeowners' pockets.
But turning these ideas into reality will probably have to wait until President-elect Obama takes office. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
How many times over the past month or two have you heard me say profits at this company or that failed to meet expectations? Well, today Hewlett-Packard announced fourth quarter profits actually beat expectations. And even more stunning, the company says the future somehow looks good. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports nowadays a little good news goes a long way.
Hewlett-Packard's fourth quarter earnings were up nearly 20% from last year. Yeah, last year, when the stock market hit an all-time high and most of us couldn't spend fast enough. How did the world's largest computer company do it? Diversity, says Bill Crayer, a tech analyst with Edward Jones. He says HP has made itself a one-stop shop for businesses.
If you're an enterprise, you can work with Hewlett-Packard not only on your PC business, but also your server business, printer business, and IT services business.
HP's strong quarter and its bullish outlook for 2009 send an important signal to Wall Street at a time when other tech companies are struggling. The economic crisis has hammered sales at Intel, Cisco, and Dell. Jack Ablin is chief investment officer for Harris Private Bank in Chicago. He says HP is an important bellwether.
HP is situated at the crossroads of both consumers and businesses, and to have great news come out of a company like that is finally some good news in this desert of ugliness.
Investors were thirsty for that good news. HP shares hit a six-year high today, and the entire tech sector got a boost. Ablin says that's because HP's results also hint at something else.
My sense is that the one surprise next year is going to be business spending, and tech is a beneficiary of that.
Ablin points out that before the economy fell apart, businesses were sitting on mountains of cash.
Going into this downturn, companies were armed with one of the most bulletproof balance sheets that we've had in decades. They enjoyed double-digit profit margins for 20 consecutive quarters.
Abelin says whereas consumer spending has gotten us out of the last couple of economic downturns, business spending may be what pulls us out of this one. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
As Stacey mentioned, HP stock had a whiz-bang day today thanks to that earnings report, up 14%. Otherwise, lots of bouncing around in the markets. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, on to bailout fallout part two. Today was a long day of hearings on Capitol Hill. The afternoon session convened in front of the Senate Banking Committee. Alan Mulally from Ford, Bob Nardelli from Chrysler, Rick Wagner from GM, and Ron Gettelfinger, the head of the United Auto Workers Union, were at the witness table. All four were trying to make the case that the auto industry, at least the Detroit part of it, needs help, and it needs it now. Micheline Maynard covers Detroit for the New York Times. Mickey, good to talk to you again.
Thank you, Kai.
You know, there are a lot of car plants in this country not run by Ford, GM, or Chrysler. So if one of the big three does wind up shutting down, is there a chance that those foreign car makers that make cars here in this country could pick up the slack?
I think they could pick up a little bit of the slack. The plants that are run by Toyota, Honda, Nissan, they actually have some extra capacity. The plant that Toyota has down in San Antonio, Texas, for example, has actually been closed because they were making too many pickup trucks.
Okay, so that's on the production side. They could make the cars and get them to market. What about the people that Detroit would inevitably have to lay off?
That's a touchier subject because not only did the car companies pick the states where they wanted to be, they handpicked the workers as well. And nobody will say we deliberately picked workers who were against joining unions, but nobody's unionized any of those plants. So I think it would be an uphill battle for somebody who was a union member at a Detroit plant to go down south and try to get a job at one of those non-union plants.
Let me just throw a parenthetical question in here. Since we are buying less cars in this country, that means we need to sell less cars. So even if there is a bailout, Detroit's going to be smaller. There are going to be layoffs.
That's absolutely true. Dealers go out of business day by day by day just because of the economic crunch. And 2 years ago, the automaker sold about 17 million cars. It looks like they'll sell about 14 million this year, and it's possible that that'll drop to about 12 million next year. So as everything goes down, everything shrinks as well.
Let me pick up on that point you made about dealers. As Ford and GM and Chrysler stop selling cars and their dealerships inevitably go out of business, are we going to see on those big auto mall streets that we have all over this country expanded Toyota and Honda dealerships?
I don't think so. You know, General Motors, I believe, has about 6,000 dealers in the United States, and Toyota only has 1,300 if you include Lexus. Their goal is not to add more dealerships. Their goal is to have more sales per dealership. That keeps everybody in the dealerships happy. They're making money. They would just as soon keep the dealerships at the same number. They just like more business in them.
So what's your gut telling you, Mickey? Is there going to be a bailout, first of all? And if that does not come, then what happens?
I don't think there's going to be a bailout in this round. I think it's very possible that when President Obama is in office, that they'll give it another try. What will happen between now and then are going to be some very difficult choices for the Detroit car companies. They may try to hang on until they have the hope of another shot at a bailout, or they may have to go ahead and look at some kind of a reorganization, either inside bankruptcy protection or outside of it.
And would that necessarily be a terrible option?
It's a very painful option, but I've covered six bankruptcies in the airline industry, and many of those airlines came out even stronger and leaner than they were before. It's not an easy thing for workers to face, but on the other hand, jobs are preserved and companies have a little bit brighter future.
Micheline Maynard covers Detroit for the New York Times. Thanks, Mickey.
My pleasure.
Commentator and writer Todd Buchholz has been listening to the debate over help for homeowners, whether or not taxpayer money ought to be spent to save mortgage holders who are in over their heads. He says, nuh-uh.
Get this. I think we should treat struggling delinquent homeowners like Donald Trump. No, not the Donald Trump of 2004, who saved NBC, fired people for fun, and wore his hair like crop circles. I'm talking Donald Trump of 1990. He'd bought up too many casinos, built too many condos, and tumbled towards bankruptcy. To save him and his many houses, bankers snipped up his credit cards, Gone were dinners at Lutece. At one lunch break, Trump sauntered to a phone and dialed up the local McDonald's from memory. Which reminds me, what exactly do we expect of delinquent home dwellers who are looking for the government to bail them out? Shouldn't they have to cancel their HBO? Shouldn't they at least prove that they care more about their homes than about their home box office? And how many of those dwellers actually put any money down to begin with? Remember stated income, false hope? The Federal Housing Finance Agency should aid only those who actually put down real cash and had skin in the game. Why? Because the government's program might encourage more delinquencies. If your neighbor gets bailed out because he's behind 3 months, why should you skip Starbucks in order to keep up with your mortgage? Now, before you think I'm Mr. Potter from It's a Wonderful Life, let me make one thing clear. The government should help. Congress should give bigger tax credits for new homebuyers, and Congress should cut the Social Security payroll tax to help the decaying job market. But no matter how many magic wands Ben Bernanke and Hank Paulson flail, you cannot have people earning $80,000 buying homes that cost $1 million. Not unless they have a rich uncle. And guess what? That rich Uncle Sam ain't so rich anymore.
Todd Buchholz was a White House economic advisor to the first President Bush. His latest book is called New Ideas from Dead CEOs. Show us you're alive. Send us your new ideas. Go to marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. One of the things that makes this financial crisis unlike some of the others it's been compared to is how quickly this one went global. European banks are in deep trouble. The Chinese economy has slowed 30% already. But you don't have to go quite so far away to see how the fallout's affecting other parts of the world. The credit crunch hit the Mexican economy fast and hard. So investors started looking for safety by buying dollars. That sent the value of the peso down nearly 40% against the greenback, and it hasn't come close to recovering yet. For the first of two reports, we sent Marketplace's Dan Gratch to assess the damage.
Miguel Rodriguez fixes laptops. A lot of laptops. His company, LapsTech, has 12 branches and 80 employees. Rodriguez expected to do $4 million in business this year. That was before the Mexican peso started losing value. Today, store shelves are filled with hundreds of repaired laptops, unclaimed by their owners. That's because Rodriguez buys his parts in dollars, and he bills in dollars for the repair. To customers paying those bills in pesos, that's a price increase of around 30%.
With the devaluation, customers are reluctant to pick up their laptop. They know it's going to be more expensive, and they prefer to wait for the dollar to stabilize or go back down.
The economies of the U.S. and Mexico are deeply intertwined. Half of Mexico's foreign investment comes from the U.S. 85% of Mexican exports go to the U.S. But with the American economy on the skids, exports to the U.S. are falling, and unemployment in Mexico is rising. Rodriguez, the owner of LapsTech, places the blame across the border.
Those U.S. banks don't realize that because of their loans, economies that did nothing wrong are being hurt. It's collateral damage.
The damage started in September, when investors panicked and pulled out of emerging markets because they were too risky. Otón Ruiz Montemayor ran the Mexican bank Banorte for 8 years. He says investors sought a safe haven in the dollar.
You get a market crowded, everybody buying dollars. What happens? Well, from 11 pesos to 14 pesos and 40 cents.
Jesus Villarreal is with Technolab, a Monterrey company that buys medical equipment from the U.S. He got a bill for $30,000 the day the peso tanked. He's calculating how much extra he had to pay due to the devaluation.
$12,000? Yeah. One day, yes.
The plunging peso has rocked confidence in Mexico's economy. Andres Franco oversees foreign investment for the state of Nuevo León, home to Monterrey. He says 10 foreign companies have put off their investment plans for at least a year.
That obviously affects us. That's less jobs that are going to be created because of that investment that is being postponed.
How much money are we talking about?
Between $350 and $400 million.
Not all Mexican companies are calculating their losses. The weak peso makes Mexican products cheaper. That's good for exporters. Mexican labor is cheaper, too, so more companies may eventually open plants in Mexico. Then there's tourism. Cancun and other hotspots are becoming good deals for Americans. Mexican businesses have been through this before. Eduardo Elizondo runs Solo Toner, a successful copier supply company. His business has endured hyperinflation, devaluations, and a 1994 banking meltdown known as the tequila crisis.
We have had a lot of bad times in the economy in Mexico, and we have learned.
Elizondo says copier sales have actually increased 60% since the peso started losing value. His customers are rushing to spend their pesos on necessities now, in case the currency becomes worth even less. In Monterrey, Mexico, I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, Dan's going to take a look at what happens when Mexican immigrants here start sending less money back home. Coming up, starting up while the economy is slowing down.
What I'm seeing is a lot of people who have been laid off from companies. So they're deciding this is a good time to launch a business, even though it may be very difficult.
But first, let's do the numbers. Lately, the final hour before the closing bell has been a doozy, and today was no exception, except that we got good news from the trading floor. The Dow gained 300 points in its final 60 minutes. The Dow Industrials met the bell up 151 points, 1.8% to finish at 8,424. The NASDAQ edged up just 1 point. That's about 0.1% to end the day at 1483. The S&P 500 bumped up 8 points, 0.9%, closed at 859. One reason for the movement was that fund managers had to find an S&P 500 replacement for Anheuser-Busch. The brewery was officially acquired today. That is, the deal closed by the Belgian company InBev for $52 billion. Medtronic cut its earnings forecast more than analysts expected. As a result, the world's second largest maker of medical devices bled 13% today. Overseas, London's FTSE was up 1.8%. The Paris CAC 40 advanced 1.1%. Frankfurt's DAX gained 0.5%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.53%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Want more from Marketplace's special Fallout coverage? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, explainers, and videos. Go to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on new home construction for the month of October. The Senate Judiciary Committee holds a hearing titled Helping Families Save Their Homes, the Role of Bankruptcy Law. And the House Financial Services Committee hears testimony from the CEOs of Ford, Chrysler, and GM. The topic? How to prevent a big wreck in the auto industry. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The global financial crisis is getting all the press, but there are problems elsewhere. They're talking about one of them in Rome today. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization is meeting on food security. The word security there really means, is there enough of it at reasonable prices? In a report earlier this month, the FAO said, not really, no, there's not. And that amid all the talk of bailouts, nobody is talking about food. Joachim von Braun is with the International Food Policy Research Institute in Washington. Dr. von Braun, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Earlier this year, we had a food crisis caused by high prices. This report out from the FAO the other day says those prices are down and commodities prices are, in fact, down. But it also says we're going to have another food crisis next year. What's going on?
prices are down. They are not down to where they used to be 2 or 3 years ago. But now we have the second blow to poor people, and that is the financial crisis undercutting their possibilities to invest.
So what we have here is yet another trickle-down effect from the financial crisis on Wall Street.
Well, it's trickling in big gushes. The financial crisis has just come when the world was trying to get ready to transfer capital to the developing world's neglected agriculture because there were growth potentials, but now that has stopped, and small farmers, now that prices are down, they make no money. So it's a very messy situation which will breed more hunger in the next year.
Isn't there a benefit, though, from lower prices? That is to say, on the consuming end, people are having to pay less to eat.
That benefit was very welcome this summer. The urban poor really benefited from the lower prices. But the next food crisis is pre-programmed because the investment is now not forthcoming. The stocks are so low that the needed productivity increases are not happening, and the world is continuing in a precarious situation, especially in Africa.
You know, the response to the financial crisis has been all about stability, making sure that there is no collapse. Is there a way for the international food community to make sure that there is no collapse before this crisis that you see forthcoming in the next year, year and a half?
Stabilization must come first, and the price bubble which we had, partly due to speculation earlier this year, was a very bad blow to poor people. Because during the food crisis, markets and trade did no longer function well. Lots of export stops, countries didn't trade with each other anymore, just at the time when trade was so essential.
Joachim von Braun is the director of the International Food Policy Research Institute in Washington. Dr. von Braun, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
We told you earlier about Hewlett-Packard and the rare dose of good news it delivered this morning. But HP is not only an economic success story, at least this quarter, it's a famously positive entrepreneurial story as well. Bill Hewlett and David Packard started that company in a garage in Palo Alto, California, almost 70 years ago. This week, thousands of people are attending events around the world as part of something called Global Entrepreneurship Week. It's a program designed to encourage entrepreneurship among young people. One of its founders is the Kauffman Foundation, which you should know is an underwriter of this program. But no matter where the money is coming from, is this any time to start a new business when the economy is shrinking? From the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman reports.
When I started checking with entrepreneurs about whether this is a good time to launch, I got one answer over and over that I didn't expect. It's all about disappearing jobs, they said.
If you want to hire people, they'll readily join you, especially if they've been laid off, as is happening right now.
That's Vivek Wadhwa. He's founded two technology companies and now researches entrepreneurship at Duke and Harvard. Robin Jones is also getting a bounce from others' employment adversity. She has one Silicon Valley startup under her belt and is launching another in high-end cell phone accessories from Portland.
We are actually seeing the effects of having the best people that are either getting laid off or are consultants that were always booked that aren't always booked now.
Not only will potential employees and consultants return phone calls these days, they'll work for equity in addition to cash. And there are other advantages to starting up in recession. Rent is cheap, and people like web designers and graphic artists may offer their services at a discount. After all, they're hurting for business, too. Over at the Small Business Development Center in Portland, advisor Jackie Babicki-Peterson is also seeing unemployment and entrepreneurship meet, but not necessarily in a good way.
What I'm seeing is a lot of people who have been laid off from companies, so they're deciding this is a good time to launch a business, even though it may be very difficult.
Many of these people will rush into business for themselves without sufficient planning, Babicki-Peterson says, and with little or no savings, they'll use personal credit cards to get going.
Just pure startup money is now and almost always has been pretty impossible. Credit cards are an easy way to go, and they will kill you.
All of which doesn't leave her feeling very hopeful for many of today's unemployment-induced entrepreneurs.
We have a big failure rate already, as it is, and, you know, I think we will have more failures.
But that's not nearly so likely with seasoned entrepreneurs like Robin Jones. She and a business partner in Singapore have self-funded their company, called 88 Inc., to the tune of $75,000. They've developed a line of jewelry that doubles as consumer electronics. Think Bluetooth earpiece in the shape of a fancy necklace. Now they need $350,000 in angel investment to get into stores like Neiman Marcus and Barney's New York by fall 2009. Jones's pitch is ready-made for recession.
I think there are a set of investors that recognize that the best time to invest is when values are low.
Meaning investors can buy stakes in hungry startups on the cheap. People like Jones need the money, and investors who have lost big in stocks and real estate need the bargains. Vivek Wadhwa points out that the Fortune 500 is full of companies that were founded during downtimes, from Johnson & Johnson to Disney, Cisco, and Intel. But isn't this a different kind of recession, with bank lending seized up and widespread financial panic? That is the view of at least one leading small business organization I talked to, which right now is not predicting a big surge in startups. But Wadhwa says that's the wrong conclusion to draw from current economic conditions.
After every crash, it looks like the world is going to come to an end. We'll be back on track in 2 or 3 years. By that time, you've gotten your business model working. You've gotten your products perfected. You know your customers. You know your market space. And now you can go to the angel investors and venture capitalists and, you know, pitch a real company to them.
Wadhwa says the challenge, as always, will be money. He says banks and investors are very tight with it now. So if you don't have funding from your own nest egg or from friends and family, you can pretty much forget about going from zero to startup during this downturn. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight 423 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce emissions. CSX, how tomorrow moves. And by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, Yahoo shareholders gave departing CEO Jerry Yang $1.5 billion push out the door today. That's how much more the company's worth this afternoon than it was at the close yesterday. Yang, who co-founded Yahoo 13 years ago, announced last night he'll step down as soon as the board finds a replacement. One reason he's on his way out is that he turned down a $45 billion offer from Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer back in January. Yahoo shares closed at $28 the day that bid was made. Today, $11.55. Any guesses out there as to how long it takes for Microsoft to make a new bid now? Anyway, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 151 points, 1.8%. The NASDAQ added a point. We'll call that flat. The S&P 500 gained 8 points. That is 0.9%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins, Renita Jablonski, and Doug Krisner on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, Pepsi saves cash by not wasting water.
We challenge ourselves to save 20% per gallon of Gatorade. And as of right now, we're tracking at 15%.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.